Okay. Sophie Reed, Sinaloa.
Jason Cortland, writer, co-director.
Julia Halperin, co-director.
Great. You know, what I like about this movie, first of all, I would say I really enjoyed the picture, you know, very much. And what I like about it, it's the story of this interloper who comes in to a family, and she's hitting all the marks, you know, as, I mean, I'm not making a pun there when I say it either, you know, like that, but she's hitting all the marks for bringing herself into this family. But there's still this sense of uneasiness throughout the picture. Can you talk about that kind of mood, and maybe, you know, if y'all want to talk about that, and maybe I'd like to hear from you about your character as well. So,
well, I think there were a few different ways that we talked about how we wanted to approach the story. I mean, we started out very much talking about elements of suspense in writers that we really like Patricia Highsmith and Georges Simenon, and also films that we like by directors like François Ozon and Claude Chabrol and Michael Haneke. But then there's also, because we're in Texas, there's also this tradition of the stranger comes to town that we were also very aware of. You know, and these things all, you know, we were kind of carefully crafting the pieces and kind of fitting them together in different, you know, kind of story drafts and figuring out, you know, how we want to deal with, you know, some themes like, you know, how Patricia Highsmith deals with doubles and how, you know, Clint Eastwood, you know, appears in the landscape and how, you know, how to withhold information in the right kinds of ways to pull the audience closer to you. So those were all sort of how we wanted to approach suspense and how we wanted to approach creating a story about two women. I don't know what else. What do you want to say?
What was the first thing you were thinking of when, you know, you said, well, what is the first thing this character needs to say in order to, I mean, first of all, it's a very shocking thing to come out and say, I'm your half-sister. But then how do you make that for Allison's character? How do you make that believable for her in order to, what are those beats that you think you need to hit?
Well, I think, I mean, Merle's character says, I guess I shouldn't be all that surprised. So, I mean, the character of Wayne for us was like, you know, what I would call a structuring absence. You know, we had a lot of ideas about who he was, even though we never see him, we never hear him. But, you know, he's a character who has influenced, or a presence that has influenced the other characters. So, you know, it had to be believable to Merle that, like, sure, my dad could have done this. My dad was a touring musician. My dad was, you know, a bit of a ne'er-do-well. You know, that has to be something that, you know, and Allison is a very, you know, she's a very thorough, hardworking actor. So, I mean, there was never a moment where I felt like Merle, there was never a moment where I felt like Allison failed to anticipate, you know, that would be part of her, how she had experienced her dad.
There's a scene in Heartworn Highways, the documentary, where I think it's a New Year's Eve or a Christmas Eve. It's a Christmas Eve scene at Guy Clark's house where he and Steve Earle and a bunch of and Suzanne and a bunch of people are kind of all gathered around drinking, you know, red wine out of jugs and, you know, playing different songs. And in the background, you kind of see these, like, dirty children in diapers running around, and you know, it's the sense that, you know, the children are there and they're part of it, but they're really so clearly not part of it.
They're kind of climbing on people's laps, but you know, it's Christmas Eve. Like, kids don't want Christmas Eve to be like yet another night of,
yeah,
you know, cigarettes in the ashtray and you know, empty wine bottles.
But that was, you know, we sat down when we first got Sophie and Allison in Austin. You know, we sat down and we really wanted to show them, you know, that scene from that film, because it was really, for us, and I think hopefully for them, was this very crystallized vision of like what childhood in that family might in Wayne's, you know, house might feel like, and for Merle that's a nightmare, and for Sinaloa maybe that's, you know, a fantasy.
How was that instructional for you, so
Watching that scene?
Yeah.
I mean, it highlighted, there's a scene in the film where the two sisters talk about, well, Mel talks about an experience and they both have incredibly opposite reactions to it. Whereas Sinaloa, for her, that would be heaven, and for Mel, it was a very different reality. And I think that extract from the film that they showed us was a real like visual indicator of that difference between them. Earlier you talked about hitting marks.
Yeah.
I think something that we have to acknowledge is that she, Sinaloa, felt the absence of her father from the age of 9, in that there was just no more contact. So in terms of hitting the marks when she finally reaches Texas, in her early 20s, there's been a long period of preparation, mm-hmm. of thinking, why? And in terms of the first meeting with Merle, I think it was a huge tactic on her part to try and destabilize, to just find out, are you the reason? You know, and that's with all interactions, like, how can she get to the truth quickest and smoothest, I guess.
For your lead, you needed a singer, you needed an actress, you needed somebody who could play music at the same time. How did you find Sophie?
We worked with a couple of different casting people, but our first person who helped us cast our leads was a casting director named Sammy Birch, and you know, we were very committed as a team to find somebody who was a triple threat, who could do all three. There were certainly people along the way who said, you know, just cast a known actress and do a hand double, and that's just not how we wanted to approach this film. So, I mean, Sammy cast a very wide net internationally and looked at between 400 and 500 actresses and musicians. Some of them were very experienced with, you know, very known credits, and some of them were new, and some of them were established musicians. And, you know, it didn't take us very long, you know, through, you know, kind of callbacks and interviews to kind of narrow a short list down, you know, to one person that we wanted to work with. Sophie just really clearly had, you know, the training and the talent and just the right personality.
And a dedication, because, you know, Sophie played a little guitar, but she worked really, really hard with Colin Gilmore to learn this style of guitar playing and to kind of just strengthen her skills. And so, you know, the work ethic was really important as well.
And you mentioned this a little bit after the screening, you know, talking about getting the role and, you know, how you had grown up in loving music and theater and the like as well.
So. Yeah, when I got this breakthrough down, I was on a train, I remember it, and it, just the first two words, vagabond musician, and I'd just been, like, waiting for something like this to come along, because, like, all the breakdowns, I'm going to get carried away here, but... So, like I said at the screening, my background, there's a huge amateur musical theatre scene in Brighton. It's like, creativity is popping out the woodworks. There's so much opportunity for that. And there's a big stigma with musical theatre in particular, that it's a narrowing box, that you're not going to be taken seriously, that you're not going to have the same opportunities as everyone else in you know, acting roles. People, you know, presume that you're not a good an actor simply because you have music in your background. And that's always been, like, so bizarre to me. And so I'm so excited and impassioned and, like, really proud to have carried on with that training and gone on a musical theatre course with at the Royal Scottish Academy, which has just been voted top 3 schools worldwide. It was just such a welcome thing to have this breakthrough come down that encompassed all aspects of storytelling. I was talking to someone yesterday about the Game of Thrones and Daenerys and how there was a concert. I think it's coming to Austin, where you can go along to the live gig and see, like, the live musicians playing the theme tunes to each song. And, mm-hmm. like, music is so much for a character, what tells the audience who they are. And to have a film where it's the characters themselves producing the music, that to me is just like an absolute dream come true.
You know, speaking of the music, I mean, I again, the progression of the music and the songs in the film, you've got originals, you've got this beautiful murder ballad, Pretty Polly, which I love as well, and you know, and talk about how the music itself, you know, carries this story too.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, one thing that another reference that we brought into this was the film Tender Mercies. And we were really fortunate enough. It was very much kismet that as we were working on the script for this, that Bruce Beresford had seen our last film on a festival jury in Iran, and reached out, just wrote me an email kind of saying how much he liked the film and if there's anything that he can do to help us. And it's just, you know, we literally watch Tender Mercies. It's one of the films that we watch every year, just because out of love, because we need it, you know, like we need good nutrition.
As an aside, I program a film series, a classic film series for our radio station as a fundraiser during the summer, and I'm showing Tender Mercies this summer. So I love that movie too.
Yeah. Fantastic. And he, you know, he was coming to Texas. Baylor brought him to show Tender Mercies, and it was the first time he had seen it since the film came out.
He didn't watch it.
He actually went out drinking with us.
I think that's a don't go down that chance.
But he's a lovely, lovely man. And he really, really loved the script, and he really loves the film. but how the songs work in Tender Mercies was also certainly an influence. I mean, it's very much about reaching into the character's past and kind of getting into a deeper sense of history and a deeper sense of landscape and culture for who these people are. And it was really important for us, you know, to understand some more about the family dynamic by the lyrics and kind of the mythology of what's going on in those songs. So the original songs, you know, there's two or three original songs that were written. I wrote the lyrics and Colin Gilmore wrote the music, and you know, I give Colin the ultimate credit for why those songs work, because he's such a fantastic artist, and second generation, you know, Texas musician. You know, Jimmy Dale's his dad, and Colin really grew up in the Lubbock scene. And then Colin also curated a number of local songwriters, like Bonnie Whitmore and Betty Sue, and brought in Butch Hancock, and Bob Livingston, and his stepdad, Richard Bowden, to play fiddle for us. I mean, and it was just really, you know, became one of our key collaborators in terms of making this feel real and making it, you know, not a carpetbagger drama. It's really important to us to make sure that, you know, our films are collaborative, and that, you know, the people that come in, like our live sound recordist, Paul Tui, and our sound mixer, Chris Keelan, they all are really part of this team to make the fabric work.
The other thing I'll say about Tender Mercies, and this wasn't a direct influence, but I think thematically it is there, you know, the Robert Duvall character's daughter, the Ellen Barkin character, is kind of like she's you know, she has sort of one tragic moment and then she dies, and so Sinaloa is in some ways like a reimagining of who that character might have been in a certain way, of like, what would it be like to have this, you know, absent father? What, you know, what does that do psychologically if your father is, you know, this famous but not present character in your life? So I think, you know, I think there's kind of a subconscious alternate reality of Sinaloa as like a, you know, an alternate version of that character.
What do you think is, what do you think then is driving Sinaloa? You know, you talked about how she was without a father since age 9, and that she had been preparing for this moment. We don't know if she's preparing for this moment several times at all. That's kind of unanswered by the film as well. But what do you think is driving her? You know, maybe if we guess that this is not the first time this might have happened, you know, what is driving her?
I feel like, I guess, justice. To have been innocently and unwillingly ostracized for something that she never had control over, like I think at her root she's a very like pack orientated person, a very family orientated person, and to have it just taken away or have it die out, like her mum dies when she's very young, and just to have this feeling of not belonging, with no, that she never like invested anything other than existing. I think it was definitely like a, I deserve to have my, I want to get her heard. I want my voice to be heard. I want to not just be this secret anymore, and to be recognized and not to be like glorified or like claim, you know. Early on in the film, there's references. Mel refers to Sinaloa wants to listen to and have record of her dad's music, and there's a sense of Mel being like, oh, she's here. Maybe she's here for the money. Maybe she's here for something materialistic. And it's not. It's not that. It's just wanting to be seen. So I think that's kind of what drives her, is wanting to not be just not.
Yeah, and then, I mean, it seals that when she cuts the ear from that joke. She's like, this is not what I'm, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And also to, with the music as well, to belong to something. I think just wants to belong to something. I think at the heart of everything, like, people don't want to be ostracized. It's like a deep-rooted fear of being shunned from the pack. And like I said, she has been. And this is her way of finally being heard and belonging to this music, and also finding out a whole side of herself that she's never even had a chance to know about. Mm-hmm. Again, going back to that, like, knocking off marks.
Yeah,
I think she had such a clear idea of what she wanted, and what she didn't expect was to feel any sort of tenderness towards Mel. Was not to feel. She didn't expect to feel kind of a shaken emotionally and have things stirred up like they did, which is why there's a certain sense of, like, things start to unravel, not just for Mel, but for maybe for Sinaloa as well.
Well, and she says, yeah, because, like, towards the end, she's telling Mel, hey, come with me. Come on, we could really be a good team.
Yeah, and that's definitely, like, the big dream, like, just to belong to something, have a friend. She's like a lonely person.
Yeah.
Very lonely person.
Something you mentioned in terms of casting too, that I wanted to ask about, which was at the screening, you talked about there being a dearth of dramatic tapes really to look at, you know, and I'm just, from an outsider looking into the scene, I guess, why is that? Is it because there are just more comedies and things being made or something like that?
I was saying specifically for Latino actors.
Oh, okay, for Latino actors.
That,
okay,
that
yeah,
like,
yeah.
We were very committed to the fact that, you know, Merle's fiance was Latino, and that's just something that happens in Texas, and it's not what the story's about, but it's, you know, it matters. It's an old Texas, new Texas, you know, newer Texas theme. It's sort of all the layers of Texas history are there, and we felt that was important for Merle's character. But casting that role wasn't easy because there were very few Latino males doing dramatic roles that we could even look at. They were either kind of thugs, or they were action hero wannabes, or they were comedic friends, but there just wasn't a lot of material. And it sort of perpetuates, like, well, it's too hard to cast a Latino actor because we can't find any, you know. So, and we were sort of steered by someone, you know, like, well, maybe it doesn't really matter, but we fought to keep that, and we fought to dig really deep into the pool of kind of, you know, material that we could look at to find some candidates for that role.
And I have no doubt that there are, you know, many, many, many talented actors.
Absolutely.
who could do this part. I mean, we feel blessed to be working with Luis Bordonada. But, you know, the problem is that there are so many stereotypes out there for, you know, it's the majority of the roles written for Latino actors are stereotypes. And so it's very hard to kind of just look at something and get a fair objective view of, you know, what their capabilities are, because they're being boxed in so tightly.
It sounds like something, I mean, really that, I mean, I guess maybe I had just kind of like been aware of it, but not, you know, consciously aware of it. Because, I mean, I see the movies that are cast and coming out of San Antonio, too, where we have a predominantly Latino population. And, yeah, it's a lot of, like, here's the crime stuff, mm-hmm. you know, action, smash, grab mm-hmm. type thing. And that's unfortunate. There's only I can probably only take two hands, if that, to name, like, the really good dramas I think that have come out of at least South Texas that I've found in the most recent years. So,
yeah, I mean, again, there were definitely, you know, a number we found through a lot of legwork, we found a number of great actors who, you know, we would have.
But it wasn't that big of a number. It should have been, for the amount of work we did. Yeah. We should have been able to find a lot more.
Yes.
And you would in any other, you know, if it was like a white, you know, man in his 30s dramatic actor, that wouldn't be a hard, it wouldn't be hard to come up with like 100 names. Yeah. And it, you know, I agree with Jason, the talent exists, but the roles to see them in don't exist, so, or don't exist in large numbers.
Well, what are your plans for you know, taking this film beyond its premiere here? What do you hope for?
You know, we developed this film internationally. We had help from the Venice Film Festival's Biennale College Program and Rotterdam Cinemart. And also through New York's IFP, as well as local programs like from Austin Film Society, a ton of support from AFS. So we definitely have you know, an international premiere as kind of a next big step. We're also talking to distributors now. It's the, you know, the having a great launch at South by Southwest is a place where people are seeing the film and talking about the film, and so we're hopefully going to have, you know, more opportunities going forward.
All right. Well, thank you all very much. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.